Before Colin Kaepernick, there was the godfather of activist athletes, Muhammad Ali.
Black athletes and black people in general in this country were expected to be obedient and subservient and keep their mouths shut. And if you were lucky enough to get rich and famous, you were expected to go along with the white man's rules and enjoy your success and don't put up a fuss. And Ali changed that.
We revisit our conversation with author Jonathan Eig in his book about Ali's complicated life. Plus, the Me Too campaign continues to reverberate around social media. But what about when sexual harassment happens in a bar?
One of the things that my staff is very aware of is to be direct. So when a situation like that does arise, it's very important that my staff is immediately responsive and direct to the situation.
That's all coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Your local bar is where everyone knows your name, right? Well, the reality of nightlife isn't always so cheery. If you mix alcohol with crowds of people, maybe amorous people, you've got a potent cocktail. Chicago Tribune reporter Allison Bowen relays some of these unsafe scenarios in her feature for the paper, in which she asks the question, what should bartenders do when customers feel unsafe? It's a timely question, especially as we've seen our social media feeds filling up with the Me Too hashtag, people sharing their stories of sexual harassment and assault. I think you could use the hashtag Me Too for basically any woman who's ever walked into a bar in terms of how they've had to maybe deal with some unwanted attention from a man. Allison Bowen is here with me in our Chicago studio to talk about these issues of bar safety. We've also got Louis Mendocino on the line. He's the general manager of the Coba Lounge in Chicago, as well as head of bar operations for Riot Fest. Allison, Louis, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
So, Louis, let's start with you. If a customer is feeling safe or uncomfortable, is that something you're always kind of keeping an eye out for?
We do. I have a great security team here because we're also a music venue, and we find ourselves in situations quite often where it could turn in the wrong direction. But our demographic is generally self-policing, which I think is something that we're really proud of. One of the things that my staff is very aware of and I think is a general policy of ours is to be direct. So when a situation something like that does arise, it's very important that my staff is immediately responsive and direct to the situation. We don't have any signaling or silent, you know, call-outs that I've read a lot about within this industry. We just go right to the source, and we open up some dialogue and have the conversation. And I do trust my people to assess that situation in the appropriate manner, or they can reach out and find me or one of my middle managers, and we can go assess that situation for ourselves. But I think that customer health and well-being is a very important thing for us, and we do keep our eyes open and our ears at all times and make sure people have a comfortable environment to meet people and date and find themselves in situations that could be precarious.
And Allison, you start off your piece by talking about this. You're nodding, saying that bartenders generally agree the best way to deal with a customer is to be direct. Sure. Especially if it's someone who's harassing people, to get them out of there as quickly and quietly as possible. But as Louis said, with online dating, with people meeting up, strangers, maybe people meeting, there are other ways that that customers may need to get out of an uncomfortable situation, right?
Sure. Yeah, and so many of the bartenders I spoke to said this is not a new topic to them. They talk about it all the time, kind of keeping an eye on customers and weighing, you know, whether and how to intervene. So a couple different ways that they do that is one is something called an angel shot, which is kind of code for a cocktail you can order. You can order an angel shot or an angel, you know, on
I've never heard of this before.
I had never heard of this either, but the way
so
this,
I feel like
yeah.
This is not necessarily a great remedy if people haven't heard about it, but maybe they're listening to it now.
Yes, that's such a good point, because what I found with this story, how it began was a friend saw a sign telling women in a women's bathroom in a Chicago bar that they could order an angel shot. And I thought, that's interesting if bars are doing this, but I went to all these bars that were supposed to have them and they didn't have the signs up. So it raises huge question of if there's a secret code, but women or men don't know about it, you know, how can they ask if bartenders are trained to respond to something, but the clients themselves don't know.
Yeah, Louis, see, you guys don't do that. You don't really have a secret code, do you? I think you guys are just, you're relying on your security to sort of also just keep an eye and just determine whether or not someone needs help.
We don't do that. But it's not that we have a fundamental opposition towards it. It's just something that we haven't implemented because I think that you're right in saying that quite a few people don't really know that that exists. And I've heard of it before, but it's not something that I think is as commonplace as maybe it should be. And I think it's something that, you know, should have a little bit more reach. And I think that people should be more aware of it because, I mean, I think it's a great idea, to be honest, especially if somebody is a little more timid and unwilling to reach out to security or management or a bar or even a patron to say that they're in an uncomfortable situation. And I do, in essence, rely on the experience of my staff and the qualifications of my staff to assess the situation and kind of be the person that steps in and asks the right questions to find out and assess if there is a problem there. As far as an angel shot goes, I think it's a beautiful idea, and I'd love to see it be more widespread if possible. I think it would just take an entity to step up and go around to local social environments and put that in the forefront.
And so the angel shot, Allison, explain, if you ask for an angel shot, what does that mean?
So if you order an angel shot, you're essentially signaling to a bartender that you need help. And there's specific kinds. There's one with lime, one with ice, and one of them is, you know, can you order me an Uber? And one is to call the cops, and the signs explain all of that. But also what I found when I talked to bartenders is many of them knew about this but also said, no one's ever asked me for that, but they have asked for help. You know, a woman might say, this guy won't leave me alone, or can you, you know, get me out of here, basically. And so I found it interesting all of the different ways they manage that. Some will just kind of quietly print the bill and put it in front of the person so they know they're not welcome anymore and kind of give them a chance to leave quietly, which everyone said was essentially the ideal solution is the person leaves, and often victims don't want it to blow up into a bigger scenario either. Or they might take the next drink and put it on the opposite side of the bar to get the person, you know, physically away. And of course, it just depends, you know, what's happening. But I thought it was so interesting, all of these different things they've already thought of and already do.
Yeah, Louis, how do you handle that? Because you said you rely on your staff. So what kind of things do you teach them to communicate with people? And is it just, as you said, being direct, like, hey, do you need help? Is it as simple as that?
It almost is. I mean, we are very direct, and we just want to open up some dialogue. So if we see an uncomfortable situation, we'll literally approach that situation and say, hey, something seems a little off about this. Is everything okay? And we'll address each individual within that situation and allow them a safe space to kind of say what it is that they're feeling, and then we'll assess from there. And oftentimes in a bar setting, that situation doesn't necessarily arise. I would say more than 50% of the time, that situation arises after there's already been a few drinks involved. It's not something that happens right away when people are still being cordial and getting to know each other. It pops up after they're 3, 4, 5 drinks deep and things start to get weird. And that's when we can really step in as a secure entity and say, hey, you've been overserved. Is there a problem here? And we can ask one of the parties to leave and separate the situation based on the comfortability of the other party. So I think each individual situation is curated based on the situation. There isn't really a hard or steadfast guideline to deal with each one because no two are the same when you're dealing with a situation like that involves alcohol.
I think one pro of the angel shot that people would note is, or having some kind of sign in the bathroom or somewhere where only women can see it, is if a woman is on a date with a guy or feeling uncomfortable, she may not want to say in front of him, you know, that she needs help. Or she might, if there's a sign everywhere in the bar that says, order an angel shot if you need help, and the man can see that too, then he might also know, right, what she's saying. So I think one key point of kind of having that be almost like a code is only the woman knows. And also there's a group here in Chicago called Good Night Out that is starting to offer posters that bars can put up and just say, essentially, you can ask, you know, our staff for help. They're trained.
Yeah. And so that's Megan Mossel, right? She co-founded a Chicago chapter of an organization called Good Night Out. What do they do, Allison?
So they do trainings in bars and music venues. And I'm glad we were talking about music venues, too, because, of course, it makes sense. It's so crowded, you know, can get rowdy, those types of situations. And they get all of the staff together and talk through what might constitute harassment, how they can respond to that, and kind of help establishments come up with a policy for how they're going to respond to that. And they also print posters that essentially say, you know, we're here to help. And the idea is that ideally if you're having an issue, you see one of the posters, you remember that you can ask the bartenders and maybe you can go up to them, or if the guy's going to the bathroom or something, you know, say, hey, you know, can you help me out here?
Or you can always go to the bathroom, the universal excuse
right.
for when you want
right.
to get
or
out of
leave.
A bad conversation.
Sure.
You know, Louis, as I'm thinking about this, I feel like I have been in situations where I have a friend who's a bartender, and I remember having a drink with him, and it wasn't his bar, but the guy next to us was being kind of a jerk. And I remember him saying, he kind of standing up and saying to the guy, like, look, you know, you're not behaving well. And him just sort of, and I think also because being a bartender and someone who's owned restaurants and runs establishments, he was very comfortable doing that in a place that wasn't his. But I wonder, do you feel, and I feel like I hear this from a lot of men, that first of all, A, they're shocked that this happens to every woman, and that they're shocked that that this is a kind of a common thing that every woman will tell you, yes, I've had to deal with the creepy guy at a bar. But do you expect, or do you encourage, or do you have words of advice for other people who are maybe seeing this happen? Do you feel like, what do you think their role should be in this?
Honestly, I think we're in a unique and insulated situation at my establishment. We have a very artistic and counterculture demographic that stays here. And I don't think there's a person in a bar stool, even right now, that has any issues standing up and essentially confronting a situation that they deem inappropriate at any time. So, and that's where that self-policing comes into play, is just as much as my staff and my core security team, my clientele is on the forefront of that fight as well. And I think we're lucky in that sense. And I don't believe that translates to the majority of situations, even within Chicago. And I do think that it's important that people get involved. And I think that maybe that should be part of the conversation with something like Good Night Out. And there should be posters, not just in the women's room, but maybe outside in the public eye, that says, hey, if you see an uncomfortable situation between anybody, then it's your responsibility to say something to the staff first and foremost and allow them to assess the situation as professionals. So I do think it is the responsibility of everybody in the public scene, whether they're working or not, to get involved and stand in front of this type of issue.
So, and your advice would be, if you're in a bar or a place or a music venue or wherever, a night out kind of drinking situation, you see something happening, rather than get involved, you would say, hey, alert the be your first course of action for someone who's a bystander?
Well, I think that depends on the bystander. I mean, truth be told, I'm not afraid to get punched in the face. So I'll stand up and say anything to anybody if I feel like there's something going on, or there's an issue, or there's an uncomfortable situation. Not everybody's like that. And if you're not like that, then yeah, of course, stand up and talk to the staff. You know, determine the situation based on even your level of inebriation. You know, if you're drunk, don't get involved. Go talk to staff. Say, hey, there's something weird going on over here. Go handle that. Or, you know, let management know, or let somebody know. So, yeah, I believe that, you know, it really depends on the situation. It depends on the person. But, you know, absolutely, I think that staff and management of any, you know, brick-and-mortar establishment should be the front line of that fight. But that doesn't mean that people can't voice their opinion as well. You don't want to see a confrontation, but say something. I mean, it's everybody's responsibility.
Yeah, and Allison, as we think about that, I think we've been having such a conversation this week about that, right? You published this piece a week ago. This week, we've seen all the social media with the hashtags saying Me Too, posts from people, mostly women, telling stories about how they've been sexually harassed or assaulted. I wonder how this past week and all of this sort of national discussion we're having about this has affected the way you see this issue now.
I think, well, you know, as a reporter, I'm always thinking about how this affects other people. But one thing I think this conversation has brought out this week is just the idea that everyone might have a different reaction or a different comfort level with how they respond to these things. You're never prepared to be in a situation where something terrible is happening to you. You know, you're going out with your friends, you're dancing. Life doesn't prepare you to get groped on the dance floor. So everyone might respond differently. And I think it's important to note that no matter how strong of a person you are or how much you know what has happened is wrong, that doesn't mean that you might immediately do whatever outside.
Right, you have the right reaction.
Correct. And there's many reasons people might not say something or might feel uncomfortable. If you're on a date, this guy might have your phone number, your information. People feel in danger, you know. So there's a lot of reasons that people might people might have different reactions to things. And I think I was talking to a therapist this week about the Me Too campaign. And she mentioned that it's a perfect example of how some people might find sharing their experience healing, but for others it can be re-traumatizing. So it's just, it's different for everyone, and everybody has a different reaction. Life doesn't prepare you for these types of things.
Yeah, thanks for that. Louis, any other final words of advice as we think about this issue?
No, I think you're both kind of right on the mark, especially with what's been going on via social media and the Me Too campaign, so to speak. I think that it's time. I think it's every man and woman's responsibility to kind of stand up to this type of thing and voice their opinion and get involved instead of just being a bystander and watching it happen and bearing witness to something that is essentially a social injustice. And I think it is our responsibility to say something. Every patron, every manager, every employee within this industry, whether or not you're here for the fun or here for the money, I think you should be involved in this conversation and stand up when you see something and say something and stop it in its tracks. I think it's a really important part of this culture, and I hope that it continues on that road.
Thanks for that. That's Louis Mendocino. He's a general manager of the Cobra Lounge in Chicago. He's also the head of bar operations for Riot Fest. I want to thank Allison Bowen with the Chicago Tribune. She's a featured reporter. We will tweet out her story so everyone can see it all across the state. Allison, Louis, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Today's sports headlines and columns are filled with opinions about what athletes should and shouldn't do when it comes to their political beliefs. Should they refuse to stand during the national anthem or refuse an invitation to the White House? It wasn't so long ago that Muhammad Ali forced Americans to ask a similar question. Should athletes fight in a war they don't believe in? Ali spoke out against the Vietnam War in 1967, telling a Chicago Daily News reporter, "I don't have no personal quarrel with those Viet Congs." It would become one of his most famous quotes, and after he officially filed paperwork to excuse himself from service as a conscientious objector, he went on to become one of the most famous anti-war figures at the time. Longtime Chicago-based journalist Jonathan Eich relays this complicated time and the entirety of the life of Muhammad Ali in his new book, aptly titled Ali, A Life. He's here with me in our Chicago studios. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
So Ali was still alive when you started research for this book. And I think there are so many ways that you kind of view him, depends on how old you are. And I think there are younger people who sort of know him vaguely as a legend, but only saw him maybe in real life lighting the Olympic torch. And I think there are people who grew up adoring him and still think of him as the greatest athlete of all time, not to mention his incredible impact on culture and on the way he defined how Black men are seen. And then there's this whole larger-than-life persona in his personality, as much as any specific fact or event. The famous trash talker that we associate with float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. Hey!
I'm here with Sugar Ray. Joe Lewis is flat-footed, and Sonny Liston is flat-footed. Sugar Ray and I are two pretty dancers. We can't be.
As a journalist, how do you try to get to the truth of that?
To me, it was one of the greatest opportunities to tell a story that's just so quintessentially American and covers so much of American life. It covers race, religion, politics and sports, obviously, you know, not to forget about the boxing. Ali was just such a huge figure. And I grew up in the 70s, and I can remember him as being more than a sports hero. He was like a superhero because he was funny and beautiful and outspoken and doing things other athletes didn't do. So trying to tell his life story was daunting, but it was also thrilling.
And as a journalist, how do you try to capture the truth between his larger-than-life persona and his personality and then the actual Ali?
Yeah, the trick is to get past the mythology, to get past the TV Hollywood version of the life and just to get into the real nitty-gritty. And I did that by interviewing everybody. I mean, I did more than 500 interviews for this book. I talked to almost everybody who knew him really well, I like to think. I'm sure that, you know, Ali was a very social person. There's a lot more people out there who I didn't get to. But all the key figures in his life really were on board for this book eventually, and I tried to talk to everybody.
And you spent years doing that.
Yes, I did. It was about 4 years of work.
Wow. So I wonder now when you think about, especially the past couple of months and all the headlines, when we think about Colin Kaepernick or Steph Curry and the positions they've taken that are public, that many people are viewing as political, how much do you think about Ali and the political stances he took as an athlete?
I think he was the godfather of this movement in a way, because before Ali, black athletes and black people in general in this country were expected to be obedient and subservient and keep their mouths shut. And if you were lucky enough to get rich and famous as an athlete or an actor, you were expected to go along with the white man's rules and enjoy your success and don't put up a fuss. And Ali changed that. When he won the heavyweight championship, the very first thing he said is, I don't have to do what you tell me to do anymore. I don't have to be what you want me to be. I'm free. And that Declaration of Independence was very upsetting to a lot of white people at the time. It was very thrilling to a lot of black people at the time.
Where do you think that came from? I mean, as you did all of this research into his life and his personality and his ambitions, as you write about that he had in life, where do you think that ties into him also saying, like what you're saying, I'm free now, I can do whatever I want?
Well, you know, it's funny. Dick Gregory, the great comedian and activist who just passed away, said to me, you need to understand, you need to try to tell me why a black kid thought he could be special in the 1950s, because we were told that we were inferior. What made him think he could get away with calling himself the greatest of all time? And that was the real challenge for me in this book, trying to understand him. And I think a lot of it had to do with his father. He was intimidated. He was beaten by his father, who drank heavily, and he wanted to prove he was better than his dad. He was also dyslexic and had a difficult time reading, but obviously knew he had this intelligence and was looking for a way to show that he wasn't just going to be limited by his inability to read. And then, you know, he discovered boxing, which broke all the rules of society. Boxing, a black kid can hit a white kid and get away with it. In boxing, when you stand in the center of the ring and they put a microphone in your face, you can say whatever you want, and nobody can edit that. So a lot of things came together for Ali in just the right way.
But there was a fallout too, right? I wonder when we think about the fallout of what of his refusing to serve in the military and that sort of pivotal moment of his anti-Vietnam War stance, what was that?
He became the most hated man in America, certainly the most hated man in white America. He was seen as a traitor. He was seen as a loudmouth. He was seen as unsportsmanlike. And when he joined the Nation of Islam, the Nation of Islam at the time was considered a terrorist group. The FBI considered them a threat to democracy. And here he was announcing that he was a part of this radical group that was even Martin Luther King said was out of line, that it was wasting its time because it refused to acknowledge that integration might be a solution. It thought there was no way that black people were ever going to be given a fair shot in this country, and the only way was to break away, and eventually all white people would be destroyed, and only black people would survive. That was the message of the Nation of Islam. So Ali became widely, widely hated.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Eig. He's the author of Ali, A Life, and there is a lot of Chicago in this, right? Because Chicago sort of holds a special place in his life. It's where he discovered the Nation of Islam. You write about during one visit, he discovered a recording of Louis Farrakhan singing A White Man's Heaven is a black man's howl. Can you explain a little bit more about sort of his encounters with his sort of the interaction between Chicago and the Nation of Islam and the role that played in his life?
Sure. When Ali came to Chicago for amateur boxing tournaments, it showed him a world beyond the little world he'd known in Louisville, which was Jim Crow South. You come to Chicago and you see black people and white people interacting in ways that you would not see in Louisville. That was one thing. And it also gave him a sense of that he could be famous, that he could be big. He was fighting at the Chicago Stadium in front of thousands and thousands of people. Here was a sense that, you know, he could be something special. And then he also encountered here the Nation of Islam, which had its headquarters here under Elijah Muhammad. And he began exploring that. He took home a record from one of his visits of Farrakhan singing this song, "The White Man's Heaven is the Black Man's Hell." And he began to really embrace those ideas that white people were never going to accept black people and that the world was made for white people. And unless black people did something radical, that was never going to change.
Before we came to America, we were living in the East. By the Nile River, we were living in luxury, enjoying freedom, justice, and equality. We wore silken robes, slippers of gold. We were the wealthiest and the wisest people, I'm told. Now we are the poorest of the poor. Nobody wants us at their door. So, my friend, it's easy to tell. White man heaven is black man hell.
Why do you think this song had such an impact on him?
Well, in part, it was because he struggled with reading, I think. So he wasn't going to pick up the newspaper. He was drawn to the cartoons in the newspaper, Muhammad Speaks. But the song was a way for him to understand. He played that thing over and over until he had it memorized and drove his family crazy because he just never stopped playing that record. And I think that the song simplified it. He was very good at memorizing. So he would memorize lines from the songs, or he'd memorize lines from Elijah Muhammad's speeches and then repeat them as if they were his own.
So there's also a colorful story about his first trip to Chicago in the book. It was a trip maybe of many firsts. Is that how we would describe it?
Yeah, I think you're referring to his lost virginity, which he said occurred in Chicago, where he took a taxi down to the South Side and hired a hooker. Ali would have a very colorful sex life from that point on, and he described that scene in his own autobiography.
How old was he at that time?
I think he was 16.
Wow. Okay. And he was legally married four times. Some of those relationships overlapped. I think you describe how one of his wives even arranged hotel rooms for Ali and his girlfriend. And I wonder, all of your research on this and all of the women in the women that you talked to about him, what it made you think about his relationships with women?
Well, it made me think that he didn't really care too much about them. He was willing to use them in ways that were really discouraging for me as a fan of his to hear about. At the same time, these women continued to love him, and they put up with so much, and I was really puzzled to try to understand why that was the case. And even now, you know, talking to these women, you know, decades after their marriages had ended, they still light up when they talk about the man. And one of them said to me, "You just couldn't be in a bad mood when he was in the room. You know, you could be mad at him, and you could say there was no way you're ever going to forgive him, but he just had a way of lighting people up."
When we also think about his way of lighting people up, right, and I think that's sort of the way he was as an athlete, would you say that you found a lot of contradictions in his life between his public and private persona, between the way that he treated women, between also how that contradicts with the Nation of Islam? Because that came into conflict. You write about that.
Yeah, there were a lot of conflicts there. I mean, he loved Malcolm X and turned his back on Malcolm X and did nothing to try to prevent the assassination. He said that his faith exalted women. At the same time, he mistreated them terribly. He said that he was a pacifist, and yet he was a boxer. And there are so many contradictions in Ali's life. Even his opposition to the war was full of contradictions, because at first he said he didn't care if we killed the Vietnamese. He would be happy to use his tax dollars to support the war. And then later he said that he was a conscientious objector. So Ali was never easy to pin down, which made this book a lot of fun to work on.
A lot of fun. You did so much research. You were able to, the first time, get a hold of FBI records on Ali. What did you learn there?
A couple things. First of all, it was interesting that they never really viewed Ali as a threat. They viewed the Nation of Islam as a threat, and they were deeply concerned.
So why do you think they were keeping files? Was this just the FBI at the time?
I think it was because they were concerned about his effect on the draft. They were concerned that if he was—
On popular culture.
Right. That, mm-hmm. that if he were allowed to get away with not fighting in Vietnam, then more and more people would embrace conscientious objector status. And in particular, African Americans might start signing up in large numbers for the Nation of Islam because it would give them protection. They were really concerned about that. And they wanted to keep an eye on him because they thought they might learn more about Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad.
More did they?
Yeah, a little bit. But Ali never really hid the fact that he was hanging out with these
right.
guys. He was an open book for the most part. So I think the FBI had a pretty easy time keeping tabs on him.
When you say the FBI being worried about his public stance, his opposition to the Vietnam War, his conscientious objector status, I wonder, you know, how you see parallels today between athletes and the different athletes who are taking very public stances. I'm curious your thoughts on how, especially as I'm thinking about you in your past work chronicling so many other careers of great athletes in America, how you sort of, if you see a difference in the way they're treated if they are black men versus white men.
There's definitely a difference. I don't think we'd be hearing all of this about the NFL football players taking a knee if they were white athletes. If they were white athletes taking a stand against the war in Afghanistan or anything else, really, or just taking a stand against Donald Trump, we wouldn't be hearing that much. Nobody complains when, you know, Bruce Springsteen endorses Hillary Clinton, right? But black athletes are under much more scrutiny, and I think it's just blatant racism that we expect these guys to have no opinions. We want them to be entertainers. We want to watch them dunk the ball, and we want to watch them catch and throw, but we don't want to think of them as real people.
Or it's people who have a political conscience or people who actually are pretty influential also.
Yeah, and the great thing is that these guys have their own platforms now, especially thanks to social media. I mean, Ali was lucky because he was a boxer and he could speak out from the ring after a fight and he wasn't really edited. But these guys, and for a long time we saw athletes really kind of keeping it quiet. They didn't want to offend their managers, their coaches, their owners.
They wanted to keep their jobs.
And they wanted to keep their jobs, and they wanted to keep their Nike endorsement contracts. But we're starting to see athletes today speak out more boldly, and I think that's a great thing.
Well, and I think when we think about athletes as role models, I wanted to ask you about Ali and the role that he played in your life as a kid. Do you remember sort of the first time you saw him, or what was it about him that captivated you?
Well, I certainly remember his fights on TV in the 70s, and I remember thinking that he was different from the other athletes that I idolized, because he was much, you know, Reggie Jackson was just a ball player on the field, and he had a personality, but he wasn't doing anything that you would get excited about or get angry about off the field. But Ali was this different kind of a person. He was an entertainer on the one hand. He was yucking it up. He was funny. He was also using his position to speak out on issues that were important to him. And it made me think, as a white kid growing up in the suburbs, what's he talking about? Who else is talking about this? What can I read to learn more about these things he's saying? And it definitely, you know, sparked something in my curiosity.
Did you ever get to meet him?
I did, really briefly. You know, I spent 4 years or so on this book, and I interviewed almost everybody who knew him well, and I spent years trying to meet him and telling his wife, you know, I really need to just talk to him and tell him I'm working on this book. And every time I went to try to meet him, he was too sick. I went to his house, spent 2 hours there, and he didn't come out of his room. But then finally I did get to meet him about 6 months before he passed away, and he wasn't able to speak. He wasn't able to talk to me, but I at least, you know, held his hand and whispered and told him I was working on this book and thanked him for the opportunity.
The book is Ali, A Life. I've been speaking with author Jonathan Eich. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with me here on
Thank
the 21st.
Thank you. This was fun.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether you want to talk politics, Drake, or find out how to talk to your parents as an American immigrant, or get NPR's Nina Totenberg to start singing opera, there's one NPR personality who can help. Of course, I'm talking about Sam Sanders. You may know him from the NPR Politics podcast or his own show, It's Been a Minute, which you can catch online or on a couple of public radio stations throughout Illinois, including our home station, WILL. Sam was actually in Chicago last night for a live show of NPR's It's Been a Minute, and he's with me on the line from there now. Hey, Sam, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I would do a hey, y'all, but you're not with your Aunt Betty. It's just you, I assume.
All good.
So, Sam, I think many listeners first got to know you on the NPR Politics podcast, and you were really in the trenches during the presidential election. I imagine the work that you're doing now is kind of a different level of energy. Do you miss that day-to-day politics coverage?
I go back and forth. You know, it's like I'm trying to think of an apt comparison. Some days it feels like I'm in the classroom watching the other classroom kids at recess playing, like on the seesaw, on the slide, on the merry-go-round, and like that's the politics team, and they're just like going. And what we're doing now is a little bit less on the day-to-day, kind of pulled back a bit, but both are exciting. And I think the great thing about the show is that I'm able to bring on members of our politics team all the time to talk about that stuff with me, so I'm not really too far gone from it.
And when you think about elections to cover, 2016 was certainly a unique one. What do you think were your biggest takeaways from covering that election?
I think in ways that we're still acknowledging, the election cycle and its aftermath and the beginnings of the Trump administration have fundamentally changed the way that most of us consume the news. Like fundamentally changed, right? Like a lot of us consume it a lot more. A lot of us let the news make us much more nervous. A lot of folks have totally checked out. A lot of the discussions around issues like politics online have become much nastier. And so, like, how do we talk about current events? How do we talk about the news? How do we talk about what's going on in this new environment where everyone's consuming things a bit differently? Like, there's this new reality of news consumption. And part of what we're trying to do with the show is speak to that, you know?
Right. And I mean, how do you – that's a really tough thing to do, right? We talk about this every day here on the 21st, and we have a much smaller net than you because we're doing Illinois, although obviously we talk about national politics too. How do you translate that into your – when I'm thinking particularly of your Friday show of It's Been a Minute?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we do every week is, like, we approach the show inherently with a spirit of optimism, and we aren't afraid to laugh and kind of poke fun at ourselves. So we want people to leave the on the episode feeling as if they've learned something and they feel like they have a grasp on what happened during the week, but they also feel a bit of uplift. Like, that is the baseline. Like, if we aren't making you smile or laugh or feel something warm in your heart by the end of an episode, we have not done our job. And we were very deliberate about that because we knew that after the election, so much of the country was and still is pissed off.
And like, yeah, people are angry. And you talk about this. People are.
Yeah,
people are angry.
I mean, like, liberals are mad. Conservatives are mad. And I am excited to be a part of a show that tries to just put some happy in the world while we give you your, you know, meat and potatoes and vegetables of news.
So, right, like, but to like the meat and potatoes. Are there stories or topics where you just think, I don't want to talk about this, I'm tired of everyone talking about this, or this person's getting too much media coverage and I don't want to do this?
Oh, yeah. The most perfect example was, quote unquote, Comey Week. You know, former FBI Director James Comey released this book, this tell-all, and he literally had the book tour that seems to just not stop.
Like, every GMA, ABC media appearance ever.
It was insane. And so we made a call early on in that week because our, you know, rap episodes come out on Fridays as a podcast and then air on the radio over the weekend. We said on Monday, we're not going to do the Comey thing. We're going to mention it because it happened, but it is not going to be the focus of our show for the week. And, you know, we have the flexibility to do that. And there's so much other news to choose from. You know, I love on the show when we can have weeks where we bring people a topic that is news, but they just haven't been thinking about it. One of the Castros died in Cuba, and that was a big deal for this nation just to the south of us, and it was an opportunity to have this really interesting talk about like where Cuba goes next, if they go anywhere next. And we could do that in a week where folks were talking about, I don't know, Russia, Russia, Russia. And it feels good when we can get those kind of conversations going.
My guest is Sam Sanders. He's the host of It's Been a Minute. If you've got questions for Sam, by the way, you can tweet us. Our handle's 21STShow. And Sam, to that point, do you think that there's a lot of stories that the national media is missing because it's sort of like this Washington cycle of everything that's coming out of the White House or all of the latest drama or iteration of things that are going on, and that's kind of what grabs the news cycle?
I do think that, like, the vast majority of journalists that I work with in my newsroom and other newsrooms are trying to get it right and trying to do right by our listeners and readers. We have to acknowledge, like, as difficult as it is for news consumers to consume the news these days, it's just as, if not more, difficult for journalists to cover this stuff. Because, like, every day the top is off the fire hydrant and it's just this flood of stuff. I think where me and others in the industry get sidetracked is wanting to tie every story to Donald Trump. You know, there is this new push to cover rural America or pockets of America that are outside of major cities or outside of the Beltway, to cover them more thoughtfully. But it is always through the lens of the election and their thoughts on the president. But, like, there are stories that affect people regardless of their politics, and we have to find ways to get in there, you know? Like, this – Donald Trump is such a charismatic figure and just made for news coverage in so many ways. I think it's – the onus is on the industry right now, myself included, to make sure that he is not the news peg for everything we do.
What about covering this guy?
That's a real one in your reflection. Without a follow, without a mention, you really piping up on these. You gotta be nice for what to these. I understand. You got 100 bands, you got a baby bands, you got some bad friends. High school pics, you was even bad then. You ain't stressing off no lover in the past tense.
Sam, I had to play that for you because I wanted to get in there and ask, what's the deal with you and Drake?
I just find him annoying. Well, first to back up. So we actually played that song to open up our weekly wrap a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you did a couple
every
weeks
Friday,
ago.
What's that?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. And so every Friday we start the show with a different song. And we started doing that basically because I don't like theme songs and I wanted to mix it up. But now we try to tie every song that we open with to a news hook. And I played that song by Drake. It's called Nice for What. I played it a few weeks ago because – with that song, he became – I'm trying to think of the right way to say it. He became the most number one-iest male artist on Billboard charts for this decade. So he's officially now the biggest male artist in the country of the 20-what-teens, right? Which is crazy because, like, I find him quite annoying. And like, I had to give honor and credit where honor is due because he's done a good job for himself. But, yeah, I don't like him that much. I think he's a little – he tries way too hard. He's like that friend in high school who wants to be in all the clubs and be friends with everybody. And I'm like, what is the real Drake? What is the real you?
He's not. Anyway, it's not the Degrassi High Drake. That's not the one.
Well, this is the thing also. Like, he was a he was a child actor from Toronto, and now his public display of self is a lot more tougher than his origins would actually suss out to be.
Last week you were interviewing Asian American actor Jimmy Yang. He's most famous for his role in the HBO hit Silicon Valley. I just want to play a little bit of that conversation.
If you're the one, you carry all the weight.
Exactly. So the problem, it's not enough representation. And hopefully, with Crazy Rich Asian, you get a whole spectrum of Asian. And I felt so good doing that movie because I can just be funny and act a fool.
Yeah.
Because I'm not representing all Asians. I'm just representing one personality.
But you know some people want you to represent all Asians.
Well, they want to blame me for something, you know, okay. Just because...
Do you ever tweet back? Do you ever write back?
I made the mistake of engaging about a week ago.
What did you do?
And it was horrible.
That's Jimmy Yang talking to Sam Sanders, who's on the air with us right now. And, you know, obviously, so I think everyone got a sense of that conversation, but you guys talked about how hard it was, and you were talking about crazy rich Asians, and people in the Asian American community are super excited about it. But you also talked about sort of the responsibility that comes with being, you know, if there aren't very many roles for Asian Americans, the responsibility that comes with that. And as I think about that, I'm one of the few Asian American, or if you want to say West Indian or South Asian, you can kind of take your pick of whatever label you want to apply. For me, I'm not that common in the public radio world. Neither are you, being an African American man. Do you feel a certain responsibility that comes with that?
I do. And there are examples of it. Like, you know, every now and then you'll get the letter from a listener that kind of says, well, I would expect that you as a black person would talk about this topic, or I would expect that you would think this way about a certain thing based on who you are. And my pushback generally is I welcome any and all advice about how to be a journalist, but I do not take advice on how to be black. And those are two very different things. And I think for the most part, generally, people are pretty open to me doing my thing and being me. But you do have to remind people. And we're in a really interesting time right now where a lot of what we think people should be and what they should say is based on their identity. And there's a certain kind of thought in the culture that, you know, Asian people should do this, and black people should be concerned about this, and women are only into these things. And I don't think that's healthy. And so I don't go out of my way to challenge those notions, but I try to make it very clear that I don't have to hold myself to them. But, yeah, I mean, I think we have a lot of flexibility on the show to really kind of push against those boundaries, in part because of the format. Like, so we're doing these Friday wraps of the week of news, but the Tuesday episodes of my show are these long-form interviews where we're talking to everyone from Jimmy O. Yang to Tim Robbins to the author Meg Wolitzer to people like Lena Waithe from Master of None. And we're being able to bring in those really deep conversations with people who in their work and in their lives are pushing those boundaries too.
Let me just ask you one last question. We just have a couple more minutes here, but how much of this do you think gets exacerbated by social media? And I feel like everyone sort of has this, I think that also kind of ratchets up everything, right? Where everyone's so outraged and there's think pieces, as you tweeted about this. Like, can we just have one day where people aren't outraged by think pieces or op-eds? How do you try to tone that down?
So I take breaks from Twitter throughout the week. So I'll have some nights during the week where I'll say, I'm deleting Twitter from my phone and logging out, and I'm not going to look at Twitter for, 12 hours, 24 hours.
You do that a couple times a week?
Oh, yeah, I have to. And I take a lot of Twitter-free weekends because I think, like, and I can't say this enough, like, Twitter is not the real world. Like, it's just not. Like, Twitter is not the real world. Like, that's the baseline. So whenever you see something trending on Twitter, know that it is trending for a fraction of what is 10% of the country. Like, that's like the baseline. So we have to understand that. So that op-ed you're mad about or that tweet that pissed you off, chances are 10 to 12 to 15 times more people didn't even see it because they weren't on Twitter, you know? And I think reminding ourselves of that is really helpful. I also think that, like, part of Twitter is, like, understanding that it is a medium that is kind of meant for quick outrage. Like, that is how you get a following and keep a following and generate, you know, retweets. So even if you like to live in Twitter, you have to understand that part of its arithmetic is meant to be an outrage machine. And just acknowledge that and say that, like, it is an unhealthy level of outrage, but, like, that's what Twitter wants and that's how it works. And we should understand that it is separate and apart. But that said, I still love it for, like, the GIFs and the animal videos and pictures.
The cute stories. Right.
Exactly.
All right. So we've got about a minute left, but I just want to ask you, you end your shows with something called Your Best Thing. What's your best thing for us right now?
Yeah, you know, so the best part of my week, and this is a thing where we have our listeners send us the sound of their voices describing to me the best parts of their week, and we get everything from graduations to new puppies to vacations to weddings, all fun stuff. I would say the best part of my week was getting to talk with Samantha Irby on stage. She just reissued her book, Meaty, this book of essays that's just delightful, and she is so fun and quick and smart and a Chicago hometown hero. And it was an honor and a pleasure to talk with her, and really enjoyable to do it in front of a room full of hundreds of fans of the show. And it was a delight. And I, as always, I love to be in Chicago. I like this place so much. So that was for sure the best part of my week.
All right. You can catch It's Been a Minute. You can subscribe to that. And that conversation with Sam Irby that will be coming out soon, I presume. Sam, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
That does it for us today. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information, our past podcasts, information about this show today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.